Here's a fact for you. Not all synthetic motor oils are created the same. Crude oil is like a bag of mismatched rocks, all different sizes and shapes coming together. Natural gas is more like a bag of marbles, all uniform in size and shape, designed to work together, reducing friction in your engine. That's why when Pennzoil reinvented motor oil, they started with natural gas, not crude. Pennzoil synthetic base oil is 99.5% free from the impurities you'd find in crude oil. So, the next time you need to change your oil, remember to ask for Pennzoil synthetic motor oil made from natural gas. It gives you unbeatable engine protection. The proof is in the Pennzoil, based on Sequence 4A wear test using SAE 5W30.
This is the best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Good Tuesday. Glad you're with us. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN 2. We are presented by Progressive Insurance. Our phone guests join us on the show, Pennzoil Performance Line. Mike Golic, Trey Wingo here as we get set for this massive avalanche of athletics, we think, that might be happening in sports. And suddenly, maybe Buster only had it right to begin with his 5%, 0% prediction in baseball. Well, it certainly seems like we're getting a lot of people that are going, hold up.
I think where we are now is there was time, right? We had time that all of a sudden we had even talked about it in July. This starts. Right. So it's becoming real. And as the decision gets closer for these, and I'm talking about the pro athletes now, I think they start to think, okay, this is now becoming real.
Yeah.
Whether it's NBA, and we'll get into all the different players in the different sports that are opting out now for COVID, for the health reasons. And I think now it's becoming real to them and saying, okay, am I going to go in this bubble for a month, for 2 months, for 2.5 to 3 months? And for baseball, am I going to start this? Am I going to get my family to, you know, in one spot? And then am I going to fly around and come back to my family? I'm going to think more about putting them at risk. NFL players starting to say, hey, we're 4 weeks away from camp. We need some more info out here. You know, give us something. So I think encapsulating what I'm saying is reality is starting to hit.
Right.
Is we're getting close to that time of commitment, or it's really going to happen, and you're getting more than a few guys. I think seasons are still going to start.
I agree.
But you're going to see, I think, more and more players, as players are opting out, start to think long and hard about, do I really want to start this season or restart the season, depending on the sport you're in.
Well, you've nailed it, because mentally when you approach stuff, you look at it in two ways. You look at it in theory and in practicality. And I think a lot of these plans and trying to get back because of the economics in it, and you know, everyone's wondering what's going on and going stir crazy at home. So in theory, this all sounded wonderful. But now, as you alluded to it, we're in what we call the practical application of that theory, and the virus may be throwing some wrenches into that, and people's situations are throwing sort of wrenches into that. Because right now we've got the Raptors. They're down there because they have to get down there early because of crossing the Canadian border to get going. And you have all these players that are saying, all right, it's like that line from Forgetting Sarah Marshall where the two couples go to dinner. And like, this is actually happening.
Yeah.
We are actually doing this. Yeah. We are actually going to let this happen. And I think that Russell Brand character is for a lot of players in the NBA said, oh, we're really doing this now.
Yeah.
You know, it sounded like a really good idea. Yeah, I think so. Maybe we'll go down that road. But now they're faced with the stark reality of this is actually going to be their existence.
We'll get into the Toronto Raptors because they've been in Fort Myers. They're kind of the practice bubble
right in
Fort Myers, and what they're doing as one player is either, and it was either Nick Nurse or one of the players that said, it feels like I'm at basketball camp.
Right.
You know, we'll tell you what's going on there. But the latest now in the NBA is Spencer Dinwiddie from the Nets tested positive. He said he isn't sure if he's going to go or not. He may go, he may not go. We all remember Wilson Chandler has opted out from the Nets.
Correct.
DeAndre Jordan has tested positive for COVID from the Nets, and he said he is out. He is not going. Now, this is a team that's sitting there ranked seventh. They aren't going to move up in those 8 regular season games left. There are a ton of games behind 6, I think like 8 games, but they could possibly be caught from behind. You have to start wondering now, forgetting even the COVID. Well, I guess it would be there in your mind. Other players on the Nets outside of, I want to go because I want to get paid.
Right.
The thought of, we almost really didn't have a shot anyway, and now we got players out, players maybe not going to be there. My God, do I really want to go outside of the fact that I'm going to go and make the rest of my money? So hard decisions going on there for that team and others in the NBA as well. And we'll get into baseball where four players have opted out. But I really think that's what it is now. We're getting the reality of the situation, and people are thinking long and hard about their family situation, who's around them, and that if they had COVID, is this worth it even after they recover to go back down?
Weren't we like a month away now from talking about could Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant get back in time to join the Nets? Yeah. I mean, that seems like eons ago.
It really does.
But the Nets are an interesting test case, right? Because when you have a couple of players test positive, what that means going forward if, you know, this sort of becomes a spike on one certain team. And here's Woj, Adrian Wojnarowski, basically talking about that on SportsCenter.
The expectation is you were going to have positive tests for players who are just living, you know, for example, these two players, DeAndre Jordan, Spencer Dinwiddie, who are in New York, who can go into the facility, play socially distanced, kind of do a workout. They're not having contact with each other on the court. So if someone's testing positive, it's coming from outside the facility, presumably, and that's the belief here. But both players would potentially have time to get past the symptoms, get to Orlando. They don't have to play a game till July 30th. But DeAndre Jordan has already ruled himself out. And there's concern on the Nets that as they lose more players, they're going to be, as they become less competitive, that it's causing other players to wonder, is it worth me going to play? And that puts the Nets in a difficult position where they might have to suffer more attrition here before they even get to Florida.
So there's the idea of whether you can field the team you want because of COVID-19, which is a big part of the NBA situation. And then there's the other part of this, which has had, we mentioned Kyrie Irving's name a few minutes ago. Kyrie Irving was one of those people that was very adamant, along with Avery Bradley and Dwight Howard, the Lakers, saying, do we really want to go back to start playing basketball right now when there feels like there's so much positive momentum for change in this country? And we've seen it, especially from the power of college athletes.
Right.
You know, it took two college athletes to stand up and say, basically, I'm not playing for the Confederate flag. I'm on the state of Mississippi state flag. And that thing is gone. I mean, that took 2 weeks. We saw Chuba Hubbard doing that with Mike Gundy. And there's been a lot of people in the NBA who've said, listen, we want to make sure that we capitalize on this momentum we have going forward. People are finally paying attention to what we've been saying for years and years and years and years. And so we've heard that Black Lives Matter could be on the courts for the NBA restart down in Orlando. And you could have phrases or something on your jersey. J.J. Redick, the Pelicans guard, was also on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt and talked about, listen, symbols are great, but action is what's really mattering here.
We're trying to figure out with the Players Association and with the NBA about putting forth real action. Obviously, it's been reported we're going to put Black Lives Matter on the court. There might be an option where we can wear messages on the back of our jersey other than our last name. But we all realize there's more to it than just kneeling at the anthem or putting up the Black Power sign. Like, we need real change in this country. We need actionable change. And we're working with the league and the Players Association right now in figuring out what that looks like and how we can invest in Black communities.
Listen, Jay Williams came on yesterday and said the same thing. He said, you know, the names of putting not the player's name on the back of their jersey, but Black Lives Matter or other things, saying I can't breathe and things like that. And you just heard it's good. Black Lives Matter will be on the court. JJ and Jay Williams are basically saying the same thing. Yep. That's great. It's good to do that.
But symbols are nice.
But there needs to be the action. And listen, there have been a lot of players trying to have a lot of say in the action going on, some who are not going to play to help, and some even who are playing will still have a platform, but that needs to be just what he said, the union and the league, which is the best league as far as union and league getting along, are in constant conversation about actionable things to be done.
Yeah, JJ also said something really interesting last night on SportsCenter. Scott Van Pelt asked him about, what does it feel like? And he said, it felt like when I was with the Clippers and the Donald Sterling thing happened. He said, there is real rage, there is real, and it's understandable because of the things that they've been trying to tell us for so long, people of color, about how they're perceived differently away from the court. And they just want to make sure they keep that attention going forward.
So the overall picture of this right now, I think the theme of this show could be reality check time.
Yes, exactly.
And not just in sports. We're seeing the states like Florida, Texas, Arizona starting to close things back up again.
Arizona shut everything for 30 days.
A reality check of we opened up and did not handle it well and now have to start shutting things back down. And now the reality check again in sports, our little world of so much that was going to go on in July. And I still think it's going to go on, yeah. But I think you may get more players than you think that are really thinking long and hard about, do I really, really want to do this? And money will be a big part of it, especially in baseball
question.
When you're talking the start of the season, even though it's 60 of 162, they're making 37% of their salary. It's still going to have some input in there, but I do think it is about reality check time because the runway is short. It's time to start lifting off, and who's going to all be on board for this?
Yeah, along those lines, I got a really interesting text from an active NFL player yesterday, which you'll want to hear. It's an interesting prediction about what may happen going forward.
There's some things going on in the NFL where if I was still playing, I would have a major worry.
Yeah. A lot of questions. Yeah. Well, at a different time
for sure. Yeah, that is true.
In a different appearance. We'll get to that a little bit later. But speaking of the NFL, coming up next, an MVP is worth half a win. Half a win? We'll explain after this.
Golic
and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm.
Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr.
So without further ado, let us bring in the most pessimistic man in America, who might be proven right on a daily basis the way things are going, our fine baseball insider, Buster Olney. Buster, we've seen a spate of positive tests. A lot of people, for a variety of different reasons of baseball, have said, yeah, I'm not going down this road. Are you feeling better about those predictions or feeling bad that you're feeling better about those predictions?
Well, and Trey, let me make clear, too. My projections are based on what I'm hearing at the team level about how this is all playing out. You know, I've heard phrases like false hustle. Why are we doing this? This is crazy. And a lot of it obviously is because there's of things going on that are completely outside of the control of Major League Baseball. I wrote in a column the other day that for baseball to attempt to restart right now is like getting into a sailboat as you see the outer bands of a hurricane on the horizon. Because you think about, the surge in numbers, about 160,000 new cases in this country over the last 4 days, and they're all centered in the most important states for Major League Baseball, Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, where so many players live. And so what I'm hearing at the team level is, great, all of these guys are going to be getting on planes to go to and report to their respective teams amid all these surging numbers, and there's a lot of curiosity and a lot of concern about what the positive test numbers are later this week.
Buster, I know that players have to be talking to one another, so what's the scuttlebutt amongst them talking with each other?
Yeah, what I've heard from players is that players are concerned. They respect the decisions of their peers, guys like Ryan Zimmerman, we heard, Ian Desmond. I do think people in the sport are wondering about Mike Trout. He was out front at the outset of this when he talked about how his wife is pregnant and if it were something to be take him away from her, it wasn't something that he was going to be comfortable with. And I do think that the peer pressure will manifest itself more when the teams get together. I heard that I had Jake Diekman, the relief pitcher for the Oakland Athletics, who is classified at high risk because he's had multiple surgeries for colitis. And he was flat out, there was no question, I'm going to try to play. Like he said, I want to try to win a championship. But he mentioned that the most important conversations might be players policing other players. I referenced that when conversation with officials at the team level in the next couple days, and the responses were basically, yeah, that's not going to be a factor. They feel like that with groups of 60 players with each team, it's going to be really difficult for peer pressure to fully manifest. It's not like you've got, 15 guys in an NBA bubble. You've got 60 players on each team, 30 teams. The math is daunting for those at the team level.
Buster Olney with us this morning, our baseball insider. And we'll get into some of these cases
Ryan Zimmerman, Ian Desmond specifically, because he had some very interesting comments he put out there on social media in a second. But the overall transparency, Buster, that we're seeing from Major League Baseball, you know, the Texas Rangers organization, employees saying they're terrified for their safety because of so many people that have tested positive in there. What do you make of the overall transparency of everybody showing exactly all these people that have tested positive?
Yeah, and it's very interesting because you see the statements put out by individual teams, and some are specific, like we saw with the Philadelphia Phillies, where they said, okay, these are the number of players who tested positive, here's the number of staff members. Other teams were more vague, and what the feedback I've gotten from players is, look, we need to know the exact numbers. When Major League Baseball learns later this week how many players have tested positive, they owe it to the players and the employees to know exactly how many people have tested positive in every organization. I sent something out along the lines of that on Twitter the other night, and I got back from folks at the team level, basically said, look, because we're trying to honor HIPAA laws, you know, we've been instructed to be more vague. Well, you would hope and you would assume that the Players Association, representing the players, will go to Major League Baseball and say, look, we need to have those numbers precise and out there so that as players make this decision whether or not to participate, they have as full of context as they possibly can about how many people in each clubhouse, each organization are infected.
Buster, where's the 60-man taxi squad? Where are they? Are they wherever they live, or are they all in one spot through this whole season? Where do they go?
Golic, and you have hit on what the reason why so many people at the team level are concerned is, you know, that baseball is so much different than the NBA. You know, in the NBA, they have a theoretical bubble, and they can create a perimeter, and they know who's going in and who's going out. These teams are in baseball are gathering. But, for example, if, in fact, they get to a regular season, they're going to, play home games, and then after the games, the players all disperse. You know, if you're the Yankees, Garrett Cole is going to go to his home. Aaron Judge is going to go to his home. And then they're around family members who've been out in the community during the course of the day. The effort to try to contain this has got to be so much greater because there's so many more portals through which players can get infected. It's exponentially more than what we're seeing in the NBA with its bubble.
Buster Olney with us. So, Buster, let's talk specifically about some of these players, including Ian Desmond, who put out some very, quite frankly, damning things on his Instagram page, talking about why he's not going out there as the Rockies a veteran. Says, think about it right now in baseball. We've got a labor war. We've got rampant individualism on the field. In clubhouses, we've got racist, sexist, homophobic jokes or flat-out problems. We've got cheating. We've got a minority issue from the top down. One African-American GM. Two African-American managers. Less than 8% black players. No black majority team owners. Perhaps most disheartening of all is a puzzling lack of focus on understanding how to change those numbers. A lack of focus on making baseball accessible and possible for all kids, not just those who are privileged enough to afford it. If baseball is America's pastime, maybe it's never been a more fitting one than now. What do you make of that scathing sort of evaluation of the sport he plays?
What he said is something that I've heard, especially since baseball this year went to its 5-round draft, where, that underscored for a lot of folks at the team level, what are we doing? You know, because let's face it, baseball has become a sport where kids with money have more access to it in this country than kids who don't have money. That's just a fact. You know, a lot of the teams, the travel teams, it costs a lot of money for players to participate in that. And there are a lot of kids who simply aren't part of that. And so this year when baseball went to a 5-round draft, and on top of that, these plans to reduce the number of affiliates, what I've heard from folks at the team level is, look, that, those guys who are later round draft picks, Kevin Kiermaier, Chris Young, the longtime outfielder, Lorenzo Cain, those guys, they wouldn't have been drafted. They may not have had an opportunity to play as much. And so there is an undercurrent of conversation at the team level about how to make baseball more accessible to minorities. Theo Epstein, the president of baseball ops for the Chicago Cubs, was very outspoken about this. And I can tell you that he was so outspoken that folks in, with other teams were kind of upset. Like, you, because you talked, you put us out on an island a little bit. But he was speaking the truth about, you know what, we have to do better to bring people, or minorities, into our game and to promote them. Because those numbers are the numbers in terms of how white the sport is.
Well, and we should point out that Desmond is putting his money or his livelihood where his mouth is. He's from Sarasota, Florida. He says he's not leaving baseball. I'll be right here at my old Little League, and I'm working with everyone involved to make sure we get Sarasota youth baseball back on track. It's what I can do in the scheme of so much, so this is what I'm doing. So he's basically staying in Sarasota, Florida, to try and get enough more people, a more diverse group of kids involved in baseball so they can understand and maybe love the game the way he loved it.
And look, if you know Ian Desmond at all, this is the, you know, the least surprising thing that he was so thoughtful in that Instagram post. He's one of the best people in the game since he got to the big leagues. He's worked to help other people. He uses platform in such a positive way. And I would encourage everyone to go to his Instagram post and read it because, again, this is someone who has, throughout his entire time in professional baseball, has worked to do good things for other people.
One thing that you know, when you were given the answer on the previous question, Buster, you said someone in baseball was a little miffed because it kind of put them on an island and put them out there. We seem to be in a year, and I know this is sports, but even outside of that, in a year, while this is a horrific year, it's a year of self-reflection, you know, kind of looking in the mirror and saying, what are we, you know, and how can we improve in certain areas? And I think it seems like Ian Desmond kind of put it together in that paragraph that he said about why he wasn't going to be playing. So after all this seriousness that we talked about, and it is damn serious, there's no doubt about that, as the baseball put out their official rule changes, please tell me, Buster, how on God's green earth players can't spit. You just let me know how a player is not going to be able to spit because it is prohibited.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's going to be spitting police down on the field because by the end
the
of Douglas,
spit
my
police.
Oh my goodness, yeah. And let's face it, you know, it's through the years I've had so many conversations with players about, you know, various moments, and they'll tell you after the fact. Aaron Boone, when he hit the home run off of Tim Wakefield in the playoffs, they don't remember anything that they did when they're going around the bases. I guarantee you that if there were spit police going up to a, you know, given player after the game and said, okay, we counted you 34 times spitting, he'd be like, I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
They do, it's part of their routine. We see guys, you know, between pitches step out of the box and adjust their gloves and, you know, spit twice for good luck over the right. Whatever it is, those are just routines. And I do think they're probably, it's going to take some time to get the players in line with it. But, you know, they might come down with a hammer if dugouts emptied in a brawl in terms of suspension and not maintaining social distancing. But spitting, I think they probably have a little bit more flexibility.
Buster, only we're all for spit flexibility on this show. That's one of the tenets that this show has been built on. So, Buster, with that in mind, you mentioned the name Mike Trout, and we've heard the possibility that it might be someone like Mike Trout who might not opt to play. And we had this conversation before the show began, and I wanted to get your perspective on it. There's no doubt that most people believe Mike Trout is the best player in the game, and he is. But in terms of a draw for the game, would it be significant in your mind if Mike Trout opted not to play, or would it be more significant because of the team that he plays for and the spotlight that is on him, whether it's fair or unfair, right or wrong, if someone like Aaron Judge chose not to play?
Boy, I do think that Trout would be the biggest name that in terms of withdrawing. And again, I have no information that that's the case. That would get a lot of attention to the sport. It's kind of like, you guys remember when we were going through the Astros sign-stealing stuff, and C.C. Sabathia said some things, and some other players said some things, and I know privately the Astros were kind of like, oh, yeah, well, it's only because you lost. And then Mike Trout said something, and then everyone shut up because he's a figure of such credibility within the sport. So I do think that he, generally speaking, is the leader. But I don't think the withdrawal of one or two players is necessarily going to lead to a wave. I think the biggest question, based on what I've heard from folks at the team level, is can everybody in these clubhouses or, you know, in these team groups start pulling in the same direction. You know, I think in baseball, what we've seen so far and what I've heard is that it really reflects the conversation going on in this larger country, that there are some players who are all in on the social distancing. They're happy to wear a mask. That's part of their routine. And other players have indicated their teams, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. What are we doing? This is all, you know, this is kind of a joke. You know, and in fact, I heard a story about one team that had some positive tests where before they got the positive test, that was the question, that there were some players in the group saying during the training, hey, you know, what are we doing? This stuff is silly. We're not maintaining social distancing is silly. And then boom. And that to me is going to be the big question. Can, you know, 30 different teams get 60 different players all pulling the rope in the same direction, including after games, basically living the lives of monks? That's going to be a challenge.
All right, Buster, we got to finish with this. You are bright light normally in the world of baseball on what Darian Mel has said, 5% chance the season starts, 0% chance it finishes. Are those numbers still the same in your mind, or have they gone up at all?
Yes, those are my numbers. I am fingers crossed. I'm hoping I'm wrong. You know, I'd be happy to come on and tell everyone that I'm wrong. But, you know, every day I make calls to folks with teams and ask how it's going. And that those projections are based on those conversations.
All right. You know, if nothing else, you're honest and you're being realistic, Buster. We appreciate that.
All right, sorry, Buster. Guys. Thank you.
See ya. Bye.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night, yeah. No doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
One, two, three, four.
Boog, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well, gents. How y'all doing?
Doing well.
Doing well, we're doing well. So we think Cam's doing well, we think the Patriots are doing well. What was your initial reaction to Cam signing with the Patriots, beside obviously this being the most Bill Belichick move of all time?
Yeah, I think we all agree with that. You know, not surprising, you know, as the dominoes fell throughout the offseason and, you know, all the quarterback seats were taken, there were only a few chances where Cam, who by and large wants to be a starting quarterback, I think we all realize that his mindset, his personality is not built for that of a backup. There were only a few starting spots left where he could go in and compete, should I say. You know, you think of New England, you think Jacksonville. Other than that, everybody else's starting job is pretty much spoken for either by an incumbent or by a young draft pick that was drafted really high. So I thought it made a lot of sense. And, you know, if you're the Patriots, to me, this is a pick that really is all about the upside and there's very little downside. Because at the very worst, if Cam is terrible, he's not healthy, you cut him, you only lose a very minimal amount of money. But if he's healthy and rejuvenated and you can build an offense around him, you're getting a guy that has MVP caliber potential. And, you know, this offense needs playmakers based on what we saw last year.
Will Cam beat out Jared Stidham for the Pats starting job? Yes. That's a loaded question. Loaded question is brought to you by Barbasol Shaving Cream, an American original for over 100 years. Close shave America, close shave Barbasol.
Booger, your biggest concern with Cam Newton?
Well, you know, for me, it's always been the same thing with Cam. I mean, if you take out 2015, which is the anomaly year, Cam has pretty much been a 55 to 57% passer. He's been a guy that's made a living more with his legs than he has with his arm. And so if you're really being honest, you got to ask yourself, how many times have we seen 31-year-old running quarterbacks dominate from an athletic standpoint with their feet? It doesn't happen often. So if you're really being honest with yourself and not living in the past, you got to wonder, can this quarterback at 31 do what's made him special? Because let's be honest, Cam's arm has not made him special. It's been his ability to elude rushers in the pocket, and now you got 6'5", 6'6", 250 pounds barreling at you, and nobody wants to hit that. If he still has that, good luck. If he doesn't, are we really thinking that Cam Newton can beat us from the pocket? I don't. So my biggest concern is he healthy? More importantly, can he stay healthy?
Well, that's the thing, right? We always say, yes, you see a lot of young running quarterbacks. You don't see a lot of old ones.
Michael Vick did it, yes. In his early 30s when he came out of prison and went to Philadelphia. He was able to run a little bit, but he certainly was a special runner.
He absolutely was. And there was the season bug in 2018 when he was paired with Norv Turner as offensive coordinator. He was hitting on almost 68% of his passes.
That's something everybody wants to bring up, all right?
Yeah.
You know, having covered, and I did a couple of Cam Newton games, everybody brings up the Norv Turner season and says, man, Cam fixed his accuracy. You know what Cam did and Norv Turner did? They stopped throwing the football down the field. Cam checked the football down. He threw the ball shorter underneath. Now, I get it. When you throw the ball shorter, you can be more accurate. But let's not make the mistake to say, man, all of a sudden Cam and Norv solved the accuracy issue. Because if you go back and look during that season, when he threw the ball over 15 yards, he was still the same guy. They just threw the ball a lot shorter and threw it to the running backs and a lot of slants that year.
It sounds to me like that's exactly the offense that we're running in New England, exactly. Though, Booger, right? We're not looking at an offense that has all downfield receivers that are going to blow the lid off the top of a defense. That's exactly what they want to run, though.
And if they do that and he can be accurate the way he was in 2018, I'll give it to you. Again, I still don't think that New England is getting Cam Newton to say, you know what? Man, Cam can be the second coming of Tom Brady, be accurate underneath, throw the football with timing and accuracy, and make good decisions. Like, you're not getting Cam Newton to be Tom Brady-esque. You're getting Cam Newton because the new NFL says we're going to spread it out, okay? We're going to go Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson type, Patrick Mahomes. It's going to be RPOs. We're going to get our quarterback in space, and we're going to allow the field to be spread and hope we can make plays that way. Like, that's the new NFL. That's what everybody is trying to get to. Look at the Chargers. Anthony Lynn said they wanted a mobile quarterback. Like, everybody is trying to go with the athletic, mobile guy. So the Patriots want to get Cam running the football. Make no mistake about that. I just hope he is healthy, number one, and two, that he stays healthy and can do it.
Talking to Booger McFarland, our ESPN football analyst and two-time Super Bowl champ. We were discussing this yesterday, Booger, what this does for New England. We and if you disagree, you can say we have Kansas City clearly number one and Baltimore number two. Then we are trying to think of, in Trey's term, three-ish, between if you want to put the Patriots in there now, the Pittsburgh Steelers with Ben back, Tennessee, can they reduplicate what they did? The Colts getting Phillip Rivers or another team in there. Where would you go after Kansas City and Baltimore if those are the two teams you have on top?
Wow. If you're looking at any AFC, Kansas City, Baltimore, Houston is a team, as much as we give Bill O'Brien a lot of flack for what they've done and some of the trades and moves that the GM Bill O'Brien has made. I mean, Houston has made the playoffs a lot. Now, they haven't gone very far, but under Bill O'Brien, they won a division and made the playoffs a lot. I got to think Houston is up there. I'm still bullish on Buffalo, and I understand people are going to look at Josh Allen very similar to what I said about Cam Newton, a quarterback that's inaccurate and erratic. But Buffalo reminds me of a couple of teams that I were on. You get into the postseason, you knock on the door with a young team, you bring the nucleus back like we did in Tampa, you bring the nucleus back like we did in Indianapolis, and when you get that group of guys who continue to work and push forward, and then finally you get over the hump. I just think this is Buffalo's year to kind of get over the hump, win the AFC East, and once you win the AFC East, you get a playoff game at home, and we'll see where it goes down the road. But I like Buffalo, but I do agree with most people that it's Kansas City and Baltimore, the top two in the AFC.
Well, with that in mind, I mean, if Buffalo doesn't win the division, there might be repercussions there, correct? I mean, because it's all been set up for them.
Yeah. I don't know how many repercussions. I think people are ready to kind of, give up a little bit on Josh Allen and the Sean McDermott experiment. I'm not. I don't think this is a make or break year for them. Our biggest problem right now in sports is we're too impatient. We want it right now. I mean, the quarterback is still young. He's building something. He got his first taste of the postseason last year, that being Josh Allen. You have a young defense. Like, the starting middle linebacker, the star player, Tremaine Edmonds, is, 23 years old, I think. So this is a very, very young team, although, Trey, there are a lot of expectations for them next season. I don't think this is a make-or-break year just yet in Buffalo.
Booger, with what's going on in the country with the pandemic, and we're seeing players in other sports before they report starting to opt out. Now, some it's a shortened season, some it's a resumption of the season. The NFL is trying to get a full season in and has about a month to go before training camp. Do you foresee players opting out in the NFL and not playing this year?
You know, Trey, Mike, I don't. I think a more likely scenario is everybody's going to show up. Everybody's going to try to give it their best foot, and we'll see where it goes. No one knows what the virus is going to do, especially when the weather turns in the fall. And, oh, by the way, football is played in the fall. So we'll see where it goes. But I got to think most football players are kind of like me and you. Like, if someone told me, hey, here are the issues, and, you know, I got $3 or $4, $5, $6 million on the table, I'm going to show up and go play. And then if something happens and I have to make an adjustment, I'll make the adjustment, but I'm not going to live in fear. I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day, and he was like, you know, I've been dealing with this for 3 or 4 months now, and I'm starting to get to the point where I feel like I'm just existing and not living. And I think a lot of people around this country are starting to feel that way, especially the athletes who already feel like they're invincible. So I think everybody's going to show up and play, man, and hopefully we can get it in. We'll see where it goes. But I don't think anybody's going to opt out for fear unless they have a very – very extreme pre-existing condition themselves or directly in their family.
Yeah, that's going to be a decider, I think, for a lot of people. So we'll see what happens. Listen, I'm with you. I think we're going to start training camp, then I have no idea what happens
from there. Yeah.
Boog, always a pleasure. Now get back on the course and tee it up, okay?
Anytime. The tee time is not till tomorrow. I have a little work to do today, Trey.
Golic and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold. It's very interesting where that went.
By our own Stefania Bell, our NFL and sports injury expert, who, by the way, again, Stefania, I think this is the first time we've had you on since the E60 with Alex Smith, which was absolutely incredible. That was an amazing thing. So before we go anywhere, I just wanted to say you and the entire E60 team, job well done on that one.
Oh, well, thank you. That was certainly a labor of love over about a year and a half, and I can't thank Alex and his wife, Elizabeth, enough for allowing us to accompany them on that incredible journey, which, by the way, isn't over. So, you know, stay tuned because you never know what's going to happen without it.
He's still trying to get him back there and play. So the caveat has always been, boy, this is a great signing for the Patriots if Cam is healthy. And he hasn't played since week 2 of the 2019 season. He was placed on IR with that foot injury, ironically, coincidentally, however you want to say it, which happened in a preseason game in Foxborough last summer, the only preseason game he played in. He's gone, had a couple of shoulder surgeries over the last couple of years, and has also just taken a lot of hits more than anything else. So let's first and foremost deal with the two most important things for a quarterback, your throwing shoulder and the ability to move, because Cam is a running quarterback, like his feet. In terms of your studying of his injuries and the things he's had to overcome, what are realistic expectations for both of those injuries?
Well, let's start with the shoulder, because going into last season, it's hard to believe it was last season. It feels like forever ago. But there were questions about his arm because he was coming off that second surgery. And when I went to camp, they were very optimistic about his arm. There really weren't many concerns on the part of the Panthers. Cam was throwing anywhere from 50 to 70 balls a day in practice. I mean, they felt like he was ready to go. And he had gotten much stronger in a lot of the muscles that support the shoulder. He was throwing with his normal arc. If you recall, when the shoulder was really bothering him, he was having to contort his body to try and deliver the ball because he simply didn't have the range of motion to accomplish a normal throwing motion. That was all rectified before the season, and then he injured his foot. So as far as the shoulder goes, I don't think there was any real concern about that. The foot was a Lisfranc injury, but it's important to remember there's a wide range of variants when it comes to Lisfranc injuries. We tend to think of the most dramatic, the fracture, dislocation, the ones that require surgery and take 6 months to recover. But there are very subtle injuries, which are mild sprains, and often some downtime will allow them to recover. That just didn't happen for Cam. It was a stable midfoot injury. There was nothing that indicated surgery, even on consecutive visits. and consultations with Dr. Anderson, who formerly was a team doctor with the Panthers, not to mention that he is now a foot and ankle doctor to pretty much all the athletes, even beyond football. So the problem became that Cam really didn't trust that foot. For whatever reason, with these subtle injuries, sometimes you just don't have confidence. It feels unstable, even if that doesn't show up on imaging. And ultimately, the decision was, okay, it's not getting better. Let's do a procedure. It was a modified procedure, not as extensive as a typical Lisfranc surgery, so much quicker recovery time. And I would just point you to his Instagram workout post, where he is running stadiums, doing these incredible agility workouts, all of the things that would test that foot. And I think he's shown us that the foot is fully recovered. So I'm not worried about his health going into New England. I don't think they are either, or they wouldn't have made the signing. They're very thorough, obviously. I think the question is going to be, can he stay healthy? That's really the question. You brought it up. His style of play has contributed to these injuries in his career. That's going to be the question going forward.
So the question I'll go from here then is, which body part, the shoulder or the foot, would you worry about the most and why going forward?
Well, it would be the shoulder, and I'll tell you why. Most throwers, you assume, have a shoulder injury related to overuse. They throw repetitively. It breaks down over time. That's the reason for the injury. That was not the reason for the injury in Cam's case. Do you remember when he was partway through the last season, 2018, where he had issues with that shoulder? It was often due to contact. Cam plays only one way, as you know, and he's a guy who I think has one of the highest percentages of goal line sneak touchdowns in the league, and he's known for extending his arm through a pile to get that first down or to get a score, and often landing on an outstretched arm is a really good way to damage your shoulder. If you go back to the original injury for his shoulder, it was when he was trying to make a tackle after throwing an interception. So it's the nature of how his shoulder was injured that makes you concerned that that could be the problem. If you look at his concussion history, it was often because he was taking big hits. I mean, to the extent that we were often wondering, was there enough? Were the penalties being called appropriately with all the hits to Cam? So I think when it comes to his physical play, you worry more about head and shoulder, because for quarterbacks, typically how head and shoulder injuries happen is in being tackled and taken to the ground.
Stephania Bell, our ESPN injury expert, is with us. And that's interesting that you mentioned the goal line situation, because obviously a couple of things to me come to mind right away. Drew Brees' gruesome shoulder injury down on the goal line when he was still a San Diego Charger, and that obviously wasn't a problem as he went on to set records and all kinds of them with the Saints. But you mentioned that sneak and how many times Cam has done that down the goal line. That was a huge part of the offense for Tom Brady when he was a part of the Patriots offense. I mean, he was considered one of the best goal line sneakers in all of the NFL. So I expect that that's something they'll try and keep in that offense going forward, because that's something that Brady, who is athletically nowhere near what Cam is, was very successful at.
But I think it said it's a different kind of sneak, right? So if you are going behind your line and just pushing forward through them, and kind of, they create a little pocket for you and you kind of dive through, that's a whole body sneak. If you're Cam, it's often a leap with an outstretched arm, which is different and puts your shoulder at a little bit more risk. So I think it's really all about his awareness of not trying to play differently. We went through that experiment before in the Panthers, if you'll recall. They were going to feature fewer designed runs for Cam, and hopefully
that lasted like a week.
Remember, wasn't it, the Lions got a roar or something of that nature?
Yeah.
And they just really couldn't do that, impose that on him, because it affected his overall ability to play the position. So you never want a guy thinking about, oh, if I do this, I might get hurt. But you do want them making smart decisions. Maybe don't leap for that extra yard or extend your arm for that extra yard unless it's a first down critical situation. Don't do it on an average play. Get out of bounds when you can. Just making smarter decisions. And I would guess that Cam's probably learned that by now. And certainly he knows the importance of staying on the field, assuming he takes over this job when he gets to New England, because he's on a 1-year deal and he has something to prove. But with him having something to prove and looking like he's in the shape that he's in, I think he could have a bounce back season.
Talking to Stefania Bell here on Golic and Wingo, and speaking of smart moves, is it a smart move, or what are the smart moves for the NFL as they start camp with some positive tests you know there's going to be, and how they proceed or try and proceed through the season?
Boy, it's a big, you know, this is actually a lot of what I've been working on the last couple months, taking a look at all the leagues and their plans to return. And I'm wading through protocols for every different league right now. And we don't have the detailed ones in the NFL because those are details are still being worked out. I think the thing that I keep hearing is, you know, we talk about this novel coronavirus, meaning it's new. And details are emerging constantly. The science changes daily. I can barely keep up with the new, the literature that's coming out quickly, which isn't always necessarily the best conducted because it's being conducted rapidly and without peer review. But people are trying to absorb information and learn on the fly as much as possible, and the NFL is no different. And as much as they have these plans and goals in place, they also understand that everything is fluid and subject to change up until the last minute. So for me, I look at where we are. We're not quite to July. You're talking about players returning July 28th. There's a lot that can happen in 4 weeks if you just look 4 weeks back. And so would I be surprised if things got delayed? Not at all. Would I be surprised if they gathered for camp but the season got delayed? Not at all. Because we just don't know how this is going to proceed. And ultimately, the Players Association is working with the NFL very closely on this to make sure that everything's done within reason, right, in the best interest of the players. And I would just point to the NFLPA medical director, Dr. Tom Mayer, his experience. He was command physician at the Pentagon during 9/11. He was responsible for diagnosing the anthrax poisoning in the postal workers shortly thereafter. He's functioned in crisis mode, and he's worked directly with Dr. Fauci in the past. So his leadership here is really integral to how this proceeds. And they're lucky to have him, but they will remain fluid as long as the information is changing.
Well, you're so right, Stefania. Look, a month ago, May 25th, Florida was taking a victory lap, essentially, thinking, look how well we've done with this.
Exactly.
And then clearly things have taken a dramatic 180 in that state, as well as states like Arizona and Texas and even California. Outside of the Bay Area counties, California has had a massive spike upward. Stefania, as always, we appreciate your time and appreciate your insights this morning. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
We're delighted to be joined by former NBA player Antonio Davis, who was, of course, the former NBA Players Association president. So, Antonio, thanks for your time this morning. We appreciate your perspective. As we see the cases spike in Florida, and we were headed down there to begin with because it looked like it was going to be a safe place and all this stuff is popping up, as someone who was not only a former player but someone who the players looked up to because you were the Players Association president, what are your concerns right now?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate you guys. You know, this is, I've said it all along, that this was going to be a thing where the NBA would do its best, NBPA would do its best to make sure they presented the most safe possible space for guys to come in and resume play. Obviously, this wasn't 100% proof, so I felt like it was going to be kind of an individual decision with every guy. You know, like some of the guys are dropping out now or saying, you know, hey, we didn't really have a chance anyway, or hey, I got kids at home that I'm worried about, or whatever. And I think everybody needs to kind of respect whatever their wishes is. From a PA perspective, if it was me, I'm telling guys to get as much information as they can, check with their own doctors and reach out as much as they can to everybody, because this isn't one thing that's just going to affect you. It's going to affect everybody. So I think as those numbers spike in Florida, we go back and we reassess. Is it the best place? Is this the best time? Is it worth it? Those are always going to be questions that are on the table. But I think in this case, and I said it before, you know, I would trust that the NBA and the powers to be at the PA would do everything that they can to make sure when they're making those decisions, it's about first, you know, the concern of the players and their health and is it the best thing to do? And not, you know, not about the dollar. I understand that's an important part of business and all of that, but nothing is worth putting all players at risk of going out there and possibly having something affect their health.
Along those lines, I want to expand upon one of you said that respect each other's decisions. So I had talked about this, and I'm looking forward to another former athlete's thought on this. I had said I don't think players can really look cross-eyed at a teammate if he decides for a health reason or whatever their reason is not to show up. Do you think there will be players that will look, you know, raise an eyebrow at a teammate who does not want to play?
I think if his decision is not valid, you know, if you don't have someone at home where there's a health issue or you don't have a health issue or, you know, it's not a health reason, then maybe, you know, I know that there's some talk of guys saying, hey, we're not going to play because of the all the injustices that are going on and the movement that's going. I think that's something that can be talked about. And there's an actual way to work through that one. But when it's health concerns and things of that nature, no, I don't think anybody should look at a teammate sideways. Now, it gets very interesting if you're on the Lakers and you got a chance to win and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, that may be different, but I think my answer would still be the same. Like, hey, this guy has an issue with his health or family's health or kids or any of that. That comes before this game. Period. So we're not going to let him in.
We did see that with Avery Bradley, who not one of the stars on the Lakers, but certainly, you know, one of their starters, one of their good players, who is not going because one of his kids, a 6-year old, has a health issue at home. I would find it hard to believe that you know Anthony Davis or LeBron James or anybody is going to have an issue with that. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's going to be an issue. And another way that we have to start looking at this too is, you know, I've had this conversation with an uncle of mine. He's like, well, if everybody else has on a mask, why do I have to have a mask? And I'm like, whoa, bro, that's not the way this thing works. Like, you got to protect yourself from others, and others have to protect yourself from others. So if we're protecting ourselves, then that decreases the chance of this thing kind of spreading. So just do what you're supposed to do. And I think a lot of times, you know, players aren't just, you know, considering themselves, because if it was that easy and they were healthy, they can, you know, hey, I'm going to go in, I'm going to do my thing and I'm going to come out. You know, if I got to quarantine myself, whatever, I have to. But, you know, I've even had situations where, like, hey, I help my mom out a lot. She's older. She has some health issues. So I don't go out. I stay in because I don't want to get her infected. If anything happens, I'm protecting myself. I'm protecting her. I'm protecting others. And that's the way we have to look at this thing.
Absolutely. As Antonio Davis with us, former NBA player and former president of the NBA Players Association. And then there's the things away from basketball and away from the pandemic, Antonio, that have a lot of people's attention. And that is the calls for equality and the pointing out of social inequality to so many people of color in this country. We heard from Fred VanVleet of the Raptors basically say the tying of this, you use the word sucks for a couple of reasons, because of the spike in cases, but also because of the awareness that has been put on this. And the NBA has said they're going to put things like Black Lives Matter, as is the WNBA, I believe, on the courts, and they'll be able to put things on the back of their jerseys. And J.J. Redick says that's fine, but we also need actual changeable actions. So while the symbolism is great, what other things do you think that players can do while they're in this bubble to sort of keep that focus on what has been the attention of so much of this country over the last month and a half?
Well, I think the biggest thing is they have to educate themselves. They have to know exactly what it is that they're fighting for and why. I've even had to go back and, you know, look at, you know, history and time after time. Hey, what has happened? Why is this happening? Why do we feel the way that we feel? although I've experienced things myself, it's important to know the big picture. And then every time you get an opportunity, talk about that. You know, how do you feel about that? And if the NBA is going to allow guys to speak on certain things, then I think that's a whole nother thing. Because when it first came out, when Kyrie was talking about, hey, I don't want to take the attention off what's going on and put it on to the NBA, my thing was, hey, that's a, you know, now you have the power. Now use that power. And it's not just about putting Black Lives Matter on the court or on the back of a shirt. It's the words that are coming out of your mouth, because that's what's going to be more powerful to people. And then I think, again, when you educate yourself and you kind of know what is it going to take to actually bring a change, voting and some of the other things that are very important, then those are the times you stand up and you have a call to action. For everybody who's watching me right now, it's important that we go out and we vote. A simple statement like that can cause huge change. And that's what's important right now. If we have this momentum, we're fighting for something, we have to keep the momentum going. The spotlight is on the NBA. I will say it out loud. Guys have a duty to talk about what's going on and how it affects them. And if they're not doing it for themselves, then do it for the people who fought before them, so that they can do what they do today, because it wasn't like that before. So they have an obligation to educate themselves and make sure that they keep that message loud and clear in front of everybody.
Talking to Antonio Davis, drafted in the second round by the Pacers back in 1990, played up through 2006. So, and then there's on the court, actual play that's going to happen. And J.J. Redick of the Pelicans said it might be some ugly play early on. So putting that player's cap back on for a minute, Antonio, outside of the getting in basketball shape by playing 5-on-5, after that, what is going to be the most difficult part of someone's game to get back after this layoff?
Wow. I mean, I was talking to so many guys and they were talking about it. It's fine to go in the gym by yourself with one other person and kind of run up and down, but your timing is going to be off. When somebody say the game is going to be ugly, what do they mean by that? Well, there's going to be a lot of off shots. Turnovers, because the timing is going to be off. If guys haven't played with each other, there's just a rhythm there that you get from practicing each and every day, running over plays, getting your mind back in that mindset. If there's no fans, that's another thing. How are you going to come in when you're tired? Because sometimes, you know, you're tired mentally, physically, emotionally, and you get in there and you hear the fans cheering either for you or against you, and you get some other energy. You know, what's going to happen when that's not there? I think this game is going to be more mental right now than physical. It's going to be very difficult getting back in shape. But as you get back in shape and go through these next weeks while they're in that bubble, it's going to be a huge mental challenge. And I think the team that can come together as a unit and kind of, you know, mentally go out and prepare each and every day for what they have to do and stick together is a team that's going to win. Obviously, the talent and all that comes into place, but it's a very difficult situation to be in because this is something you're not used to. You know, no fans and being in a bubble and thinking about all that stuff before you get on it. Can I contract and who did I come in contact? All that stuff is going to factor in, and we're going to see that early on until guys just start to relax and get into some type of rhythm.
Antonio, the mental part of it, I think, can't be stressed enough. When we talked about this with a couple of coaches, including Jeff Van Gundy, like he was like, one of the things when we had him on, he kept saying, as a coach, I would try to come up with ways to keep guys interested, to keep them in it, because there are worse places to be than in a really nice hotel. Yeah, we all understand that.
Yeah.
But it is a it is a different scenario than what you guys would be used to. Let's get through the 8 games of the regular season and then the play-in games and whatever they are. And then when you're talking about a postseason run here, you play a game, have a couple of days off in the same city, play a game the next game in the next city, and then move on with a travel day and a couple of extra ones. This is going to be a totally different dynamic from a mental perspective. Do you think, as a guy who played in the NBA when it was a physical war of attrition, much more than it is now, do you think this is going to be mentally more difficult than a regular playoff?
Oh, for sure. Not especially for those who won't be able to go home, see their family, sleep in their own bed. Like, all that stuff matters. I think that's why you see sometimes this disparity when teams go home to play. They have a little bit of an advantage. This is strictly going to be about, you know, the team and we pumping each other up and making sure, you know, whoever has that energy, we feed off that energy. You know, if you're a vocal guy, you got to be vocal. If you're not vocal, you got to be vocal. We're going to have to muster up all the energy we can mentally, emotionally for each other. Those guys on the bench are going to be so important to getting some momentum together. Coaches, all that is going to matter now where maybe it didn't matter before. You know, whether you had this routine, you're going to have to figure out a new routine. So I think it's going to be very sloppy basketball, you know, to start. I think it'll start looking a little bit better, but this is not enough time for teams to get together and look sharp and do the things that they need to do in order to consider themselves, hey, we're playing our best basketball at the best time. Because you think before you've gone through a whole season, you kind of figure some things out. And you're kind of ready to take that momentum into the playoffs. Well, you know, 8 games and sitting out for months, that doesn't happen. So what are you going to do? And nothing you can do but sit and watch film, do some other things to prepare mentally, because physically it's just going to – there's nothing you're going to do about that. You just need that time to kind of get back into some kind of shape and get back into some kind of rhythm of playing 5-on-5 basketball.
Yeah, I think the mental part of this is going to be the really, really interesting thing. Who can stay stressed, stay fresh, and who can stay focused? Antonio, as always, we appreciate your time. We hope you and yours are safe and well, and hopefully we'll have you back on as we continue to see this bubble scenario play out, okay?
No, thank you, guys. You guys have a blessed day.
Golic
makes me want to vomit and then punch you square in the face.
And Wingo.
Oh, he's saucy today.
Golic and Wingo with you, ESPN Radio, ESPN2. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All phone guests join us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Mike Golic, Trey Wingo here with you. We just completed the Travelers Championship on the PGA Tour here in our neck of the woods, TPC River Highlands in Cromwell, Connecticut. And we had a spate of positive tests for both players and caddies. But it was the week before where the PGA Tour, in its second event back playing after the hard pause before the second round of the Players Championship in March, at the RBC Heritage Championship at Hilton Head, South Carolina, after they had played the Charles Schwab Challenge in Fort Worth at Colonial, where they had their first positive test, as PGA Tour player Nick Watney tested positive for COVID and had to withdraw. So for more on that experience and being the first, something you don't want to be first at. No, normally first is good, probably never not the thing you want to be first at with this. For more on that and the experience and how he got it and how he noticed he had it, which I thought was very interesting, we're delighted to be joined now by PGA Tour professional Nick Watney. Nick, first of all, thanks for being with us this morning. How are you feeling?
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm feeling well. It's been now this is day 11 since that positive test, so I'm feeling well, and you know, I think I'm definitely on the road to recovery. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I've got it licked, but yeah, feeling good. Thanks.
So, but before we get to how you figured out you had it, or possibly the symptoms, you said day 11. What's the procedure now for you to be cleared and get back on the tour?
So, the tour has the tour recommends a 10-day isolation, and then once you complete that, then you can, if you so choose, you can go to the next event and go back into the testing protocol. I'm not going to play this week because, you know, it's been a slightly scary situation, not in terms of how I was feeling, just it was a bit of a whirlwind, and I certainly was not expecting it. So I'm going to head home, but under the tour protocol, a 10-day isolation, and then you can head to the next event.
So you've been stuck at Hilton Head basically for 11 days and are self quarantined. So what's it like being stuck in a golf resort where you can't play golf? I mean, that has to be sort of frustrating, right?
Yeah, it's. I have to say, it's been one of the weirdest 10 or 11 day stretches of my life. I mean, I have four kids at home and a wife, and usually if I'm gone, obviously it's to play and to compete, but I'm not doing much of anything at this point. So it's been a very different time, different 10 or 11 days than normal, but I obviously understand that I need to do it. So there's not a lot going on here right now, especially with no golf.
Yeah. So as Nick Watney is with us, the first PGA Tour player to test positive, the way you found out you might be sick was really interesting. And it was a device that the tour has given players to sort of monitor themselves. And that's what tipped you off, because you weren't really feeling that bad, right?
Correct. Yes. I woke up on Friday and I felt generally fine, you know, not, I think if COVID wasn't a part of our world, I didn't feel sick. I didn't have a fever or a cough. But I checked I wear a Whoop strap, and the data from that showed that my respiratory rate had gone up, about 25% from its normal rate, which I didn't know upon waking up. I mean, I wasn't short of breath. I went to the nurse after noticing this, and she took my temperature with a thermometer, and then they had a like a thermal scanner that we walked through to get onto the course. And the guy just weighed me through, and I had no fever. So due to the elevated respiratory rate from the Whoop, that's why I ended up getting a test.
So, and my wife has one of those as well. She loves it. So after you got your temperature taken and the thermal check, which you passed through, you decided even after that point that you needed to continue to, say, get this looked at?
Well, I went into the nurse, and she was kind of going down the checklist of symptoms and had said, you know, do you have a cough? No. Do you have a fever? No. And we kind of went through it, and then she called the Dr. Tom Hospital, the PGA Tour doctor, and he said, yeah, just run the test. Best case, obviously, comes back negative, and you can go on about your day. So based on the lack of symptoms and having the test run, he told me he'd asked me, do you want to play? And I said, well, yeah, that's why I'm here. If I'm negative, I'd like to play, you know. And he said, okay, so based on the lack of symptoms you can go warm up, just make sure to social distance and stay, you know, keep away from players and no unnecessary contact or whatever. And so I did that, and then got a call that I had test positive and need to go immediately, and that's what I did.
Wow. So having been the first, you're going to be looked at as, you know, the guinea pig for all of this, for lack of a better term. So how do you say the tour has handled it, and how do you think the tour is handling it going forward, as we're speaking to Nick Watney, who's still in Hilton Head? By the way, very nice place to be.
Not bad.
I'm sure he'd just like to get out of the hotel room every once in a while in a few days when you're able to do that. But how would you rate the tour's handling of this before your positive test and after it?
Well, I think the tour... Excuse me. I think the tour is doing, I think they're doing a good job. If you look at the rate of how many players they've tested and how many positive tests have come back, it's right around 1%, which I'm not sure the exact number in terms of the general population, but I don't think it's that much different. In terms of support post-test, I think they've been great to me. And then as far as tightening the protocols, I think that's what a situation like this requires, is to kind of, you know, make a plan and see how it goes and then adjust accordingly. So I think they're doing a good job. I hope that, you know, that more and more negative tests stack up and the tour continue and everybody can play safe and healthy.
Nick, one last thing. You said you're not going to the next tournament in Detroit. When do you think you might jump back on tour?
I'm hoping to play the Memorial in a couple of weeks and then play. So if I play there, then I'll play out through the rest of this condensed year. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing my family and then also getting back to competing and, you know, hopefully, next time I can talk to you guys, it's not about this, it's about something golf related.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah. About winning the Memorial. How about that? We'll put it at that. Listen, Nick, we appreciate your time. I know it's what you have a lot of right now, but still, I appreciate you spending part of it with us. Hope you're healthy and on the way to a quick recovery. Get home to see your family, and we'll see you back out hopefully at the Memorial real soon.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks, Nick. How much do you think he was chipping and putting in this hotel room?
Right? I mean, self-quarantine. There are worse places to be, but if you're in a room, you're in a room.
Yeah, you are.
And that's the unfortunate thing. You can look out and say, oh, look how beautiful it is outside. I can't get there. So that's the weird part about this, that he's sort of been stuck where he is. So hopefully he'll get home soon and get home to see his family.
But in all honesty, that is a protocol, like for baseball players, because again, they're not in a bubble. If they're on the road and someone tests positive on the road, they're staying in that city.
Yeah.
You know, just like Nick has stayed in North Carolina, a baseball player or maybe a football player, if the protocol says the same thing, if you're on the road and you test positive, you're there for a while.
You certainly are. So, again, we'll see what happens, and hopefully Nick will be leaving Hilton Head soon and getting back to sort of the normal swing of things. But it is interesting how that app, he saw that, he's like, what's
on the whoop,
something's up. Because the way I read it, it said his normal breaths were 14 an hour, but overnight it got up to 18
He said he didn't feel any difference, but it did register on the apparatus he was wearing enough for him to go get checked out. So, smart move.
Absolutely.
Smart move.
And, again, hopefully for him, he goes forward and he gets back playing and is 100% healthy.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.